Asa Parker had the town sealed. Dozens of yellow bands were out on the eastbound road and in the break southeast of Paradise. There was even a sniper post, and several riders were out on the west trail where Wolf Creek curled down from the tablelands. But from the little settlement called Paradise, there was one blind direction, north, past the Collegiate Bluff. And there, out of sight, dozens and more dozens of riders made their way toward the town. Vince Colby might have gone straight for the horse herd at Hay Meadows if it hadn't been for Tad Sands finding that calf in the gully. It was a wobbly-legged calf, barely weaned and no more than coyote bait out there in the breaks north of Rabbit Creek. It had become separated from its mother and wandered into a gully too narrow to follow and too deep to climb. Tad found the critter there, and he shot. Colby and the rest didn't mind. It was late in the day. They had traveled hard to make barely 4 miles since morning, skirting around first one squatter camp and then another to keep out of sight. Colby had in mind to come up on the Capstone Flats northeast of Paradise, then scout out that outfit that called itself A&M Land and Cattle Company. That was where some joker claimed all the lost horses had gone, and Vince wanted them. They were all broke from the last visit to the hog pens, and they needed a grub stake. So when Tad killed the calf, they were out in the breaks with evening coming on, and all of them were tired and hungry. They made a fire and butchered the calf and settled in to rest a while. And it was then that Stone found the cow tracks heading north.
I'm making maybe 50 head, 3-4 riders pushing them. They've come a piece. The way the cows keep to a herd, but this ain't no trail crew. Colby, you can tell these boys ain't drove cows before.
Rustlers. The supply trail's 50 miles southeast of here. I guess these fellers cut a herd down there and helped themselves to what they could get. What's up there that a man would drive cows to?
Kansas. If it was me, I'd be taking them up toward Hardwoodville.
That's across the line, ain't it, Moline?
Yeah, but not far. Me and Cabot know our way around up there. Not much law till Dodge. Some rawhiders got a place up there most everyone knows about. They'll buy cows, then sell the beef at Dodge. They don't ask questions.
50 head of beef, make a nice grub steak. Them rustlers ain't all that far ahead of us, Colby.
As the cattle drives began showing up, Marshal Sam Stroud was involved in the investigation of rawhiding operations over west of the Sand Hills, around Hardwoodville. The dressed beef that came in from there almost weekly, in the form of butchered carcasses hanging from the slats of high rack wagons, was stolen beef. Everyone knew it, but everyone bought it anyway, and the commerce cut deep into the profits of Saw Log and Smoky Hill. The big ranches swung some weight with the merchants of Dodge, and the merchants ran the city. They brought out so much pressure to bear on Stroud that he sent Ben Wheaton over to Hardwoodville to see if he could dig up some evidence. And because Saw Log held a seat on the Western Kansas Stockmen's Association Board of Directors, orders came out of Topeka to provide the deputy with a military escort. Wheaton and the soldiers had been digging, literally, for most of a day before they found what they were looking for. Behind Wendell Murray's place, they uncovered dozens of buried cow hides, still fresh enough to read the trail brands. Most of them were Texas stock. Murray and the half dozen men he employed on his place sat in glum silence as the stink of unearthed evidence increased. Wheaton reported to the Kansas State Militia Lieutenant John Colgrave.
I guess we've got enough evidence here. We'll haul a few of these back to Dodge and let Sam decide what to do about it.
You're not going to arrest anybody?
For what? Butchering beef? The only charge I've got here is receipt of stolen property. If I was to start arresting people for things like that, I'd have to jail damn near everyone in Dodge City.
Sergeant Jack Lyles offered his 2 cents.
How about rustling? Maybe these here boys rustled some of those critters they dressed out.
Can't prove it. And tell you the truth, I doubt it. These fellers haven't got the makings of cow rustlers. They just buy them from whoever does. Now, if we could catch us some actual rustlers coming up from the strip, That would be a different story.
Lyles looked around at the ugly chutes and slaughter pens of the butchering camp.
Are we in a hurry? Those wagons over yonder got fresh rope on their meat hooks, but I don't see any beef waiting to be loaded, or any cows ready for cutting. Looks to me like they're expecting a new crop.
I guess we could wait around a little while, just in case. Might take the pressure off Sam if we could bring in a few rustlers with fresh Texas beef. I expect that saw log outfit would enjoy seeing a real lawful trial of malefactors at Dodge City.
I don't remember that happening very often.
It's been a while. A lot of folks get planted at Dodge City. Happens all the time, but it's usually just social occasions. Been a while since anybody was hanged proper.
With Murray and his rawhiders under guard, the Kansas State Militia, or that part of it consisting of Lieutenant John Colgrave and a patrol from Company B, 2nd Kansas, waited. In the clear light of High Plains evening, they saw the cattle coming up from no man's land when the little stolen herd was still 8 miles away, 50 head or so, and at least a dozen riders pushing them. It wasn't in the young lieutenant's nature to wait much longer. It was clear that the cattle were stolen, and it was obvious they were crossing into Kansas, heading for the slaughter camp. Wheaton saddled up.
You know they'll run when they see us coming.
Of course they will. And that gives us a hot pursuit situation to cross the line. A fine opportunity to exercise the troops.
You know, you give that shaved tail a few more years, he'll be wearing birds. Maybe even commanding a regiment.
The weird spring of that year had run its course and wrung itself out. Dry, hot winds blew from the south, and the fresh green grass of weeks before had begun to parch. Proven roots sucked the last of the winter's moisture from arid, sandy soil. On a rise west of Paradise, four riders and 14 riderless horses, several of them saddled, filed down from Cap Rock just as the full sun touched the distant hill. Falcon McAllister and the Mason brothers had been on the move since morning. Moving at a steady pace, they had pushed the little cayuse herd from Hay Meadows Ranch westward, circling finally to approach from the west, while a far different kind of force gathered 3 miles above the north rim of Wolf Creek, ready to move at the setting of the sun. Falcon and the Masons paused now to watch the deployment of distant riders moving down toward Paradise. Tiny specks on the deceptive plains land, but nonetheless ominous for their distance. There were only 20 or so riders out there, but somehow their coordinated, implacable thrust toward the north bluff above the outlaw town seemed like the tide of doom descending. 20 or so motley riders, and behind them a plodding line of men on foot, were dotted here and there by ramshackle wagons, drab carts and barras, and ambling draft animals. The riders at the point all carried long guns of various types, and some of the walkers had firearms. Most, though, carried spades and scythes, axes and sledges, implements of all kinds. The entire assemblage moved toward Paradise, angling toward the east slopes of the chalk bluff that stood above the north verge of Wolf Creek.
Our pa faced folks like that in the war, just like those Barlows out yonder. Folks from Tennessee, Kentucky, Virginia. Hill people.
Pa had bad dreams all the time. I guess I see why now. When he used to talk about Johnny Reb, I imagine regular troop soldiers in gray uniforms, but he didn't mean ordinary soldiers. He meant Barlows.
In the distance below, the jumbled little sprawl of Paradise lay like thrown refuse along the south bank of Wolf Creek. Lingering breezes from the south blew across the hog pens and carried their smoke and stench toward the main town, then died against the high bluff on the north. Paradise lay misted with eddying smokes, like dying smoking embers on a trash heap.
I'd hate to be the one those dirt farmers go after.
Plain people. Just push one, push too far.
Jubilee's out ahead, getting a better look at the panorama. He moved carefully, even though the lowering sun behind him would hide him from view of the town. Joshua sat off to one side, checking the loads in his rifle and his handgun while he kept the little horse herd tight. McAllister stepped down from Diablo and took off his coat. He stripped off his linen shirt, baring his torso. The wounds were healing, but it would be time yet before the big man was truly sound.
You want to give me a hand, Jude?
From a saddle pouch, he drew out his old buckskin hunting shirt and slipped it over his head. Then, with his knife, he began making little holes in it. A string of little holes, 2 inches apart, running from breast to waist down the right side. And another string of holes on the left.
What are you doing?
Binding.
The holes completed, Falcon reached into his saddle pouch again and brought out a roll of cut thong. He began threading thong through the holes in the buckskin, left to right to left, starting at the bottom and working upward. With 2 holes on each side laced, he lapped the shirt close over his belly and drew the laces tight. They left a 4-inch gap. His cheeks paled slightly.
You do the rest. Tight as you can pull them, all the way up.
At the 3rd lace, Jude hesitated as McAllister clenched his teeth. The big man only glared at him.
Come on, tighter. Put your shoulders into it.
Jude continued the lacing, putting all his strength into the pull of the thong. Once or twice he thought McAllister's knees would buckle, but the big man steadied himself, bracing against the pull. When all the crisscrosses were tight, Jude tied off the ends in a hard knot.
This ain't ever going to be untied, Mr. McAllister. Only way to get it loose will be to cut the cords.
Falcon's heavy muscles swelled against the confining buckskin.
It'll do.
He strapped on his gun belt, tested the smooth draw of the holstered .44, and slipped the other .44 into his waistband.
It'll do.
Jubal was back, holding hard rein on a skittish horse.
Well, are we going in?
McAllister took Diablo's reins, stroked the big black's powerful neck and shoulder, then stepped into the stirrup and swung aboard. It was the first time Jude had seen him mount a horse without gritting his teeth. In the saddle, Falcon looked down at the corset-laced buckskin wrapped around his belly.
It'll do just fine.
He turned to glance at the evening sun.
Good a time as any. Let's get these remounts strung out and moving, boys. It's time to go to town.
Evening sun sat a smoky haze over the twisted warrens of sheds and lean-tos of the hog pens. Such sounds were not uncommon around the hog pens, and hardly anybody even looked around when a filthy flap was pushed aside and Billy Chalice stepped out into the evening. If anyone noticed the fresh scratches on his cheek or the blood on his hands, they thought better about mentioning it.
Damn engine whore. Not even worth the trouble.
Men stepped aside as he passed, giving him a wide berth. By now, everyone in the settlement knew about Billy Chalice, and not a man among them, not even the hawkers and vendors who prowled these alleys, was interested in catching his eye. A butcher of women, the rumor said. Crazy as a loon, and just plain mean. Billy had never been much to look at, but in the past few days, he had become a filthy, strutting scarecrow, bearded and unkempt, his dark-stained clothing hanging around him in tatters. It was as though without Tuck Kelly to rile him and ride herd on him, he'd just gone to pieces. But the unkempt, sloppy appearance of him was only surface. Like a snake shedding its winter skin, Billy was more dangerous than ever. Tuck had been, in some odd way, a rudder to him, an influence checking and balancing his wild impulses. Tuck was gone, and Billy didn't miss him. Now nothing held him in check.
Shit!
The cold water made the scratches on his face burn. The squad marked him. Now barely contained rage burned in his eyes. Wiping his hands on his stained shirt, Billy fingered the gun at his hip and turned slowly, full around, daring anybody so much as to look at him. There was nobody near. Billy turned back to the cistern and drew up another pail of water. Cupping his hands, he dipped and drank.
Turn around, you killer of women. Turn and face me.
Billy straightened slowly, and his frown became a grin of anticipation.
Now who the hell is that? You sure you want me looking at you, mister? You sure you hadn't better just shoot me in the back?
I said turn around, you son of a bitch!
Billy glanced around. The man behind him was fairly tall, slim, and somehow elegant. Dark hair neatly cut, clean shaven, cloven of foppish eastern cut. And though he stood slightly crouched, he had no gun in his hand.
Well, well, looky what we got here.
Slowly, arrogantly, he turned completely and faced the dude.
This how you want it, Bo? I'm looking at you now. Make your play.
Billy Chalice, you are a woman killer and a beast. Draw your gun when you're ready because I intend to shoot you. Ah!
Something hot and vicious smacked Brett in the chest and spun him halfway around, carrying him backward to sprawl on the littered sand.
Damn! I must be drunk. You ain't dead yet.
Standing over the fallen slicker, Billy Chalice shook his head. He hesitated, trying to decide whether to finish the dude off or let him bleed a while. Then on impulse, he put his gun away and drew his knife. The man on the ground was still moving, struggling. Suddenly, Billy realized what the stranger was doing. He was trying to roll over to reach his gun with his left hand.
Oh, no you don't. Nope. Goddamn hero, huh? Go ahead. Roll over. I never castrated a real honest-to-God dude before. Might just gut you, too. See how you holler.
The kick rolled Brett over onto his back. Pain-filled eyes stared up at Chalice, hating him. Billy dropped to one knee beside him, and he raised his knife. Billy's hat flew off, and talons of fire raked his scalp. Throwing himself to one side, the outlaw twisted and rolled. His gun came out blazing, but the shot was off. Just behind where he had been, Casper Wilkerson now stood. His dark hat, black coat, and shadowed beak making him look for all the world like a tall, somber buzzard rearing up in the evening's haze. Casper's big shotgun smoked from both barrels.
You fucking bastard!
Half sitting on the ground, Billy raised his .45 and thumbed its hammer. Wilkerson staggered back a step, then straightened and pushed fresh loads into his greener. The twin muscles came up.
God damn it, I shot you!
Billy rolled frantically, firing again as he turned. The shot was dead center, but this time Casper didn't even stagger. He just stood there, raising the shotgun to his shoulder. Billy bumped up against the cistern, grabbed the loose pail from its hook, and flung it as hard as he could. As Casper dodged it, Chalice got his feet under him and ran. Last rays of evening sun lit the smoke haze as Billy crawled under a broken wagon out the other side and dodged among the ramshackle sheds and sties of the hog pen.
Bass is trying to kill me. What the hell's the matter with him?
He cut through a stinking alley and ducked behind a shack, and then the answer came to him.
Oh, he's going for the money. That bastard Wilkerson is after the money in the wagon.
50 yards away, Casper Wilkerson paused to unbutton his coat. He had bruises on his chest and under his arms, but the iron plate had held. A 2-foot square piece of tank plate hammered into a curve and slung on harness, the thing had stopped Billy's slugs. Deep dents pocketed the rusty surface, but the bullets had not gone through. Refastening his coat, Casper hurried toward the alley where he had left his horse. He had to get back to Paradise. It wouldn't take Billy long to figure out what he was after, and then Billy would come again. The sound of distant gunfire drifting in on the evening wind was scarcely noticed in Paradise. In upstairs rooms at the hotel, a few of the day's newcomers paused for a moment to listen. John Wigginton, who led the Morley Syndicate delegation, stepped to a dusty window and looked out.
The shooting was coming from out there. That little camp or whatever it is out on the prairie.
It's nothing. That's the hog pens out there. Slaughter pens and a whiskey camp. There's always someone shooting.
Think nothing of it, gentlemen. This is a rough country now, but Let's consider how it will be when the railroad comes through with its new commerce.
We don't need drummer speeches, sir, just facts. When can we look at the maps and domain instruments?
It's getting late. First thing in the morning, we'll show you gentlemen around and then go to the land office. Plenty of time then to talk business. In the meantime, we have cooks preparing your evening meal and a few bottles of fine wine that should be sampled.
Asa Parker picked up his hat and motioned for Cipher and O'Brien to follow.
We'll leave you to your rest now, gentlemen. All of your questions will be answered tomorrow, I'm sure. Good night.
Downstairs, Asa grabbed O'Brien by the lapel and hauled him outside.
You heard me, O'Brien. I don't care how you do it. You just have all those documents in order by sunup.
He pushed the salesman away, and O'Brien brushed himself off, recovering his dignity.
I'll have it all ready, Colonel. But you'd better keep a lid on this town until everything is signed and sealed. And make them quit shooting. I can't deal with nervous buyers.
O'Brien headed for the land office, and Asa Parker prowled the street until he found the vigilante he trusted.
Smith, get out there to the hog pens. See what's going on and put a stop to it. Take some men with you.
We ain't got but 6 or 8 in town right now. Everybody's out on the roads looking for squatters.
Well, take what you can get. And bring Billy Chalice back with you. That crazy possum's been lazing around long enough. I need him here.
Yes, sir.
And see if you can find Casper Wilkerson, too. He's supposed to be here on the street. Find him.
Yes, sir.
Smith hurried away, and Parker headed for his overland wagon. From the high perch of its box, he scanned the roads out of town, east and west. There wasn't much to see.
It's one more day. One more miserable day, and I'll see the last of this hellhole.
Ducking into the wagon, he lit a lantern, drew the flaps closed, and opened the hatch on the strong box in the floor. Of the $9,000 he had taken from the Kansas Pacific Railway, more than $7,000 remained. $7,000. A lot of money in some respects, but only a drop in the bucket compared to what he would have once those eastern buyers signed over their collateral accounts tomorrow. He would leave the wagon, leave the strongbox, and leave paradise far behind. Oh, there would be those expecting a share, all right. Cipher would want half of it. O'Brien was in for a tenth. And the rest? Well, he realized that now it was down to Billy Chalice and Casper Wilkerson. Now they would want shares of the remainder. But Asa Parker didn't mean to share with anybody. The collateral funds would go straight into his own account in St. Louis, and he would be far from paradise before anybody realized he was gone. Cipher would be on his own, holding worthless paper that would trace only to him when the transaction was investigated. O'Brien might rant and rave, but what could he do? He was only a land drummer. Now, Casper and Billy were another story. He would have to deal with them eventually. When the time came, Casper Wilkerson would be no serious problem. The man was a killer, but he wasn't a gunfighter. Parker would simply ventilate him before he could even begin to raise that ugly shotgun he carried. As to Billy Chalice, Parker had little doubt that he could beat the loon in any stand-up match. It'd be close, but slick as Billy was, he still was only just a fast draw. He doused the lantern. Parker pricked his ears. Oddly, the gunshots didn't seem to come from the hog pens to the south this time. If he had known better, Asa Parker would have sworn they came from the west. Ram Sullivan and 5 other drifter vigilantes had prowled the westward road out of paradise. By the time the sun had set, their eyes burned, their tempers were short, and all but Sullivan were snugged into a little gully 100 yards off the trail, playing cards. Ram Sullivan was just about to give up and join the others when he heard the muffled hoofbeats on the road. A riderless horse ambled past. Then 3 more, 2 of them carrying empty saddles. There were others just behind them.
What the hell?
Ram tensed as a lineback mare came into view. It was his own goddamn horse, the one he had stolen back in the territories and then lost the night Jackson led the raid on Rabbit Creek. He stared at it, then at the man riding the big black stud horse just beyond it. The man was a stranger, big wide-shouldered hombre. The man reined toward him and approached, waving casually.
How do? Does that yellow neck wrap mean you're one of Ace's boys?
It means I'm Paradise Vigilance Committee. Who are you? And who's Asa? And where did you get my horse?
Oh, I'm sorry. I meant DeWitt. Colonel DeWitt. I guess you work for him, all right. I got horses here from Hay Meadows that I heard some of you boys lost.
Damn right we did. Now how'd you get hold of them?
Oh, I was there. I took a few of them myself. So you boys are still hanging on with Asa Parker, huh? Don't you have anything better to do?
It was then that Ram realized that the man had edged in right beside him, way too close. Ram went for his gun, and suddenly an arm the size of a corner post shot out. A steel-hard hand closed over Ram's gun hand.
Oh, my hand! God damn it!
Don't do that. You wish you hadn't.
Like hell!
Ram twisted, found his arm was imprisoned in a hold he couldn't break. Just beyond the stranger, a dozen or more horses were plodding past. Ram felt sudden panic. His horse skittered, and he was dragged half out of his saddle by the unyielding hand that held him.
Shit! Boys! Fellas! Help me! Shoot him!
100 yards away, surprised heads popped up from the gully's rim.
Now that was a really dumb move, buddy.
Malcolm McAllister loosened his grip and let the unconscious cowboy fall. Then reined toward the gully and dug in his heel. Yeah. A bullet whipped past Falcon's ear, and then his .45 was out. Jude Mason rode up. Falcon McAllister sat easy in the saddle of his black stallion with his gun in hand. Below him on the slope and bank, two terrified-looking outlaws stood with their empty hands in the air. Three more lay scattered on the slope, none of them moving.
Jude, better gather up those guns, then swing round yonder and pick up these boys' horses. They won't be needing them.
Hot damn!
When all the fallen guns were gathered up, Jude took Ram Sullivan's mount on lead and swung northward to bring in the picketed animals of the other five. Falcon turned to the two outlaws.
You boys are out of the vigilante business. Pick up your partner over there and get moving.
Get moving? Where to?
Someplace else. Kansas is that way. Texas is that way. There's a whole lot of no man's land out that way. Just start walking and don't stop.
You ain't gonna set us a foot out in those breaks at night.
Why? You afraid of snakes? All right, Dan, your choice. Out there, the rattlers might not find you. You come back this way, though, I will.
Shit. Come on, Sullivan. Wake up, goddammit.
Oh. Falcon watched him get their buddy on his feet and watched idly as they plodded away, going more or less southwest. They wouldn't be back. Joshua Mason rode up beside Falcon.
Hey! Ain't this something? Seems like a land with no law, just plain sprouts horses. That makes 20 right here and 20 back at the place. Found horses! This horse-taking business could be right habit forming. How you holding up, Mr. McAllister?
Falcon paused thoughtfully, then nodded. The buckskin corset under his coat was makeshift, but the chronic pain in his midsection was only an ache now. Whatever had still not healed inside Falcon, the lacing seemed to be holding everything in place.
I believe I'm hanging together just fine, Joshua.
This was all they had between here and the town. The main bunch is out east along the trail. You were right. They expected company from that direction.
Well, fine. Let's go to town.
Asa Parker climbed out of the big prairie schooner and was on his way to the cook shed, where a couple of hired cooks were pit roasting a beef for the visiting investors. Cypher and O'Brien were already there, supervising. He sidestepped as a wandering mount, still wearing its saddle, pranced from an alleyway and cut him off.
What the hell?
Several others followed. Suddenly, there were horses everywhere. Skittish and wild-eyed, the animals milled around, finding nowhere to go as riders cut them off east and west.
Lay down your weapons, Asa Parker. You're through here.
For an instant, Parker couldn't see where the voice came from. Then he spotted a big, shadowy man, tall on a midnight horse. The horses milled, and Parker took advantage of that to slip between turning animals, hidden by the shadows.
Who are you?
My name's Falcon McAllister. I'm here to deliver you to the Kansas and Pacific Railroad Company. We want to talk to you about a robbery and murder in Colorado.
Parker straightened, squinting over the backs of horses. Dust and descending darkness made it hard to see. The man wasn't where he had been. He turned, saw the tall figure again, and drew his gun.
The hell you say?
He raised the weapon to fire, but a raised horse head blocked his view.
I need help here! Intruders!
Parker scurried aside again, working toward the cookshed pits, and had a glimpse of the pale-haired man dismount over toward the hotel. Shoving and kicking at the nearest horses around him, he turned in that direction.
Stand still, damn your soul! What's the matter, bounty hunter? You afraid to face me?
No answer. On impulse, Parker straightened up to stand tall, turning this way and that, squinting and searching.
You're lying! Falcon McAllister's dead. Billy Chalice killed him up north of here.
Billy Chalice has done a lot of things, Parker, but he didn't kill me. Now this is your last warning. You surrender now, or this is where you'll die. Your choice.
Asa Parker's blood ran cold. Desperately, he wheeled around, saw no one in the choking dust, and ducked again, pushing at horse flesh and dodging hooves as he changed positions. It seemed to Parker that the dust hanging in the dark air had begun to glow, and there was a distinct smell of smoke.
Wilkerson! O'Brien! Cypher! Where the hell is everyone? Where's the vigilantes?
Standing upright again, Parker sensed the direction of the new gunfire. It was east, out on the main road.
Barlow's! Those damn squatters are trying to get to town!
Colonel!
Parker glanced up. In lighted windows of a hotel, men were crowding to look outside. Wigginton called down.
Colonel! Colonel DeWitt, is that you down there? What's happening, sir? Where did all those animals... Sheriff, hold them!
Now the glow was brighter in the dust aura. From 2 points beyond the herd, flames leapt upward. The land office was ablaze, and across from it, the old barn that had served as a tackle shop for the building of Paradise. For an instant, Parker made out the figure of a rider circling the milling herd, bunching him inward. He aimed his gun. He knew he had missed, but was encouraged when nobody shot back.
Ha! The horses. They don't want to shoot the horses.
At the noise, the herd of horses wheeled as one and bolted. Asa dove out of the path of a rearing, neighing saddle horse and skidded on its belly in the dust and filth, his arms up to cover his head as the animal stampeded over and around him. Holding Diablo on tight lead, Falcon had backed off around the corner of the hotel. But when the thunder of the stampede had passed, he dropped the reins. Stepped out to the street. There was no need to shout orders, and no one to shout them to. The Mason boys knew what to do, and they were doing it. While Jude headed off to knock down the fences at the livery and corrals, Jubal prowled the edges of the town looking for snipers. He had already found one, and the man lay sprawled under the rickety water tank. Now Jubal was out hunting for more of them, keeping pace with his little brother Joshua as the kid moved from building to building, setting fire to everything that would burn. Falcon strode the firelit street, a littered, shadowy clearing where dust still swirled on the breeze like mist on a pond. From knee level down, it was hard to see anything.
Falcon! Behind you on the roof!
Falcon ducked and turned, feeling a jab of lingering pain as his .44 came up. A man with a yellow sash pitched headfirst from the roof of the old trading post. Falcon was past the big wagon when some impulse made him turn and duck. There in the street, rising out of the settling dust, was a man as big as Falcon himself. A man with a smoking gun in his hand. Falcon dodged, tumbled, and rolled, and the pain in his middle became a living thing. Two more bullets kicked up dirt beside him, and he rolled again, coming up on his elbows to return fire. The specter in the dust dodged wildly and ran. In an instant, he was out of sight behind the wagon. Falcon came to his feet, advancing. A broken-down trough hid the underside of the wagon, and he started around it, then doubled back and went the other way. Asa Parker was waiting for him, crouched in shadows behind a tall wheel. He held a ready 45 and leaned outward, ready to shoot the instant Falcon cleared the water trough. Falcon circled around the lashed-up tongue and stepped past the iron tire of the all-four wheel.
Time's up, Parker. Colorado or die.
If he expected Asa Parker to react suddenly, he was disappointed. The big outlaw didn't move for a moment. Then he raised himself slowly. His hands went up, and his 45 dropped to the ground.
I guess you got me, McAllister. I'll come along peaceably.
Falcon stared at the outlaw for a moment, then lowered his gun as though accepting his surrender. Parker's eyes glittered in the gloom. Slowly, he lowered his hands and extended his right hand as though to shake it. The flicker of motion at his sleeve was almost indetectable. Falcon was faster. Both shots took Asa Parker front and center. The outlaw stood for a second, weaving on braced feet. In his outflung right hand was a nasty-looking little .44 Derringer, exposed as his dead fingers uncurled from it. Falcon McAllister stepped out from behind the big wagon. Joshua's fires were blazing brightly now, lighting up the whole stinking town as building after building smoldered, flared, and went up in flame. The hotel still stood, and Jubal was there, herding people out into the street, peering at him one by one as they lined up staring into the muzzle of Jude's rifle.
I want to know what this is all about. See here, you can't treat us this way. I'm Wigginton of the
Fellow... Shut up, Mr. Wigginton. I'm looking for someone, and any of you that isn't him is free to leave.
Leave?
Yes, sir, you can leave. Matter of fact, I'd recommend it. Your coaches are over there in the south pasture and all the draft stocks around here someplace.
Wiley, the railroad man, appeared beside Jubal. He pointed to a small, gray-looking man hanging back in the crowd.
There, in the rear, that's Cipher. There'll be charges against him. And him, too. Hello, O'Brien, you swindler. Looks as if the land shark business has finally turned to bite you.
Jubal glanced around at Falcon, tears of anger on his cheeks.
He's not here! God damn it, Billy Chalice isn't here!
The next day was a day of arrivals and departures, a day of change. Morning sun fell on the smoking embers and scorched remains of what had seemed a town of golden opportunity. Now it wasn't much of anything, just smoldering ruins with a big prairie schooner standing at one end and some elegant coaches loading passengers at the other. The vigilantes were gone, as were the men who had hired them. Here and there, one-time residents of the town stood around in little clusters, wondering what the hell to do. Joshua and Jude helped the Easterners hitch up their teams, then curtly ordered them aboard their coaches and watched them leave, eastward toward Wichita. The land shark and the pirate, O'Brien and Cipher, were chained to a stump to keep them out of trouble. Wiley stood guard over him while Falcon McAllister and various Barlows did an inventory of the town.
They found enough evidence to convict both Cipher and O'Brien three times over once they were returned to the realms of law and courts. But there was no sign of the money stolen from the Kansas Pacific Railway.
Soon after sunup, a man named Cass Jolly came in from the hog pens with two locals, carrying Brett Archer on a makeshift stretcher. Archer's wound was bad, and it would cost him his right arm, but he was still alive. They put him into the bed of the prairie schooner, and Jude Mason went to round up the big wagon's draft horses.
We're taking back Tom Blanchard's wagon. Joshua wants to take Brett up to see that doctor that fixed Falcon. I expect Brett will want to head out to Colorado when he's able.
Some of the Barlow riders helped him hitch up the team, and they rolled out, with Cass Jolly driving and Joshua riding along. Past the chalk bluff, they turned the big rig north. Joshua's brothers watched them go, and Falcon approached them.
What about you two, Jude?
Well, we aim to stick around for a while. Jubal, he's going to stay on with Becky's kin for a time, while them and me get all these loose horses moved up to hay meadows. We decided they're ours, since they don't rightly belong to anybody else. Mighty good horse country around hay meadows.
It was high noon when a squad of the Kansas State Militia rode in from the north, led by Lieutenant Colgrave.
Pass the big covered wagon up the way. They told us what happened down here. Anything we can do to help?
Yes, there is. I have two prisoners here, and I need an escort to Kansas. Those men over there.
Wiley pointed at Cypher and O'Brien, chained to their stump.
They are charged with various state and federal crimes, ranging from murder and robbery to falsifying government documents.
With plenty of men to help him, Jubal Mason led a search of the town and surrounding areas, looking for any sign of Billy Chalice. There was no trace of the gunman. But they did find something else. A drenched and bloating corpse was laid out on a plank in front of what remained of the land office.
This one's name was Wilkerson. Casper Wilkerson. He's one of them. One of the six who killed the Blanchards and stole the railroad money. With him dead, that's five out of the six.
Men gathered around to look at the dead outlaw, amazed and baffled.
We found him in Wolf's Creek, a mile or so upstream. Looks like maybe he fell off his horse and drowned.
How can a man drown in Wolf Creek? The water ain't hardly more than 3-4 feet deep anywhere.
I guess you could, if you were strapped into an iron keg.
He pulled back the dead outlaw's coat. Beneath it was the curved surface of heavy iron, tied on with leather straps. Falcon McAllister avoided the trails as he headed northwest, preferring the clean landscape of the grassy high plains around him.
I've done all I can do here, Marie. It doesn't bring you back. Right or wrong, though, I had to do what I could.
With the remains of paradise behind him, Falcon didn't look back. There was nothing there to see. The work that Joshua Mason had begun in burning all the buildings, the Rabbit Creek settlers would complete. When they were through, not a wall would remain standing. They would come with their picks and their plows, their spades and shovels and rakes and level the ashes. When that was done, they would put plows to it, turn it under. Nothing would remain on the bank of the Wolf Creek but a quarter section of dark tilled earth that, given a season's sun and rain, go back to the grass it was once been. Falcon rode on. Wide lands rose ahead, hypnotic in their vastness, and beyond would be the mountains and the trail home. It was time to go back, at least to look in for a time. Marie's memory was not out there in those mountains. Her memory lived inside it, and it would go where he went. Ahead was something rising above the endless prairies. Buzzards were circling in the high sky, and not far from their circle was a tendril of smoke that was whisked away almost before it was glimpsed. In an hour, he could see where it came from, and an hour after that, he found the source.
Get down, Yoneg. Got good beef here. Texas Trail brand on his hide, but nobody around to claim it. Get down and come in. I waited for you. Knew you'd come this way. Been watching you since sunup, too. Got something to show you, but eat first.
The Cherokee boy waved a casual hand toward where the buzzards were circling above a gully.
Kinda stinks over there today.
Falcon dismounted and walked to the gully. The corpse had begun to bloat and ripen, but it was still recognizable. It was the same man who had put a bullet through Falcon's chest back in the cold of spring.
Same man, sure. Same man has did a lot of bad things. Won't do that anymore. Name he had was Billy Chalice. Now his name, Nobody.
How'd you find him?
Didn't find him, Tawoti. I put him here. Followed him all the way from that town you burned. Finally caught him here.
Falcon nodded. That part was obvious. Just as obvious as what had killed Billy Chalice. His body was riddled with bullet holes. One in each knee, one in each arm, one through the neck and one through the belly.
Ujonati killed him. Took half a mile and half a day to get it done. Bullets through his arms so he couldn't shoot, through his knees so he couldn't run, in the throat so he couldn't holler. Crazy Antachi just kept trying to get away.
To get away from you?
Ujonati paused and pointed. On a rise 100 yards away, something sat watching them, inquisitive wolf ears atop a feral head silhouetted against the sky.
Not really a wolf at all. Big dog some Yoneg tried to hang. I call him Wahya. He likes me all right, but don't like Yonegs.
You're gonna be something when you grow up, Ujonati.
No, not Ujonati anymore, Yoneg.
For the first time since they had met, Falcon saw a real grin on the young Indian's face. It made him look even younger than his 12 years.
Ujonati was a war name. I'm just Wohatli now. Ujonati, a rattlesnake. He bites, but don't fly. Eagle is better. Remember about Eagle and Falcon? Wohatli flies higher than Tawotli.
Blood of Eagles is a Graphic Audio production. Production copyright 2007, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Copyright 2007, William W. Johnstone. Performed by Mort Shelby, David Coyne, James Lewis, Terrence Aselford, Richard Rowan, Mort Shelby, Karen Carbone, Michael Glenn, Thomas Penny, Michael Replogle, Kate Torrey, Dylan Lynch, Ken Jackson, and James Konacek. Additional Richards performed by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Bob Supan. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Johann Detweiler. Additional original music by Johann Detweiler. Book adapted for graphic audio by Casey Jones. Produced by Rick Rowan and Wayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. If you enjoyed Eyes of Eagles, be sure to look for our other graphic audio titles, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net. Keep listening for previews of other graphic audio thrillers.
The following previews are of Graphic Audio Productions, rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
Eagles number 7, Cry of Eagles. The trail to adventure begins for Falcon McAllister in the town of Tombstone, where his newfound friend Doc Holliday gets an invitation to a dance of death at the OK Corral.
You boys surrender your weapons, or you're under arrest.
We don't want any trouble. Throw down your guns.
Billy Clanton and Frank McClary drew their guns, and Doc shot Billy through the chest. Then he turned his shotgun on Tom and put a double load of buckshot into his chest, killing him instantly. Ike began running down the street.
Don't shoot! Don't shoot!
Wyatt allowed him to pass. Suddenly, Frank shot at Doc, but the bullet hit his holster and ricocheted into his hip.
Damn it.
It was a minor wound. Doc whirled and fired his Colt, hitting Frank in the forehead.
From there, Falcon will travel from the Arizona border to the shadows of the Dragoon Mountains, pursuing a murderous band of Apaches led by the Mescalero chief, Naiche.
Kill him. Stake him out over the ants without his eyelids, so that his eyeballs will boil in tomorrow's sun. Cut his entrails from his body in the old ceremonial way, and scalp him. But leave him alive, so this tall one who calls himself a bird will hear his screams across the desert. It will be a message to him and his friends that we want war with him, that we are ready to fight him.
Naiche's warriors are bent on the slaughter of every man, woman, and child they encounter on their way to a war council with Chief Gokale, better known as the infamous Geronimo.
Naiche saw Chakole fall. He took a deep breath and charged at Falcon, firing as he rode. Falcon leaned low over Diablo's head and kneed the big stud into action, straight at Naiche. Halfway there, Diablo stumbled in a depression in the ground. Falcon, caught by surprise by Diablo's faltering, was catapulted over the horse's head onto a patch of sand. Unable to believe his good luck, Naiche reined his pony to a halt and took careful aim with his rifle at the spirit warrior.
Don't miss 1 minute of this epic saga, stretching from the gunfight at the OK Corral to the final showdown with Chief Naiche in the heart of the Dragoon Mountains. Grab it now. Eagles number 7, Cry of Eagles.
The Biobubble sat in the red desert, burnished by silver moonlight, and looking as dignified as a child's cluster of bubbles. Until the night the Biobubble became a smoking, stinking heap of blackish-brown silicon and steel trusswork, whose pristine white paint framework turned black and bubbly as hot tar.
Now, a Fox News exclusive.
Travis Rust found himself happily sweating on national television, explaining what he was doing in the marshlands outside the Kennedy Space Center. That was before the three men in the charcoal black suits and impenetrable sunglasses burst in on mid-telecast.
Who are you people?
Hey!
Government agents.
That was the last the public saw of Travis Rust, until the world had been dragged to the brink and beyond.
To recap, Mr. Rust snapped what may be the single most important photograph in the chain of events that began with the Biobubble disaster and progressed to the Reliant catastrophe. Are these acts of sabotage warnings from a hostile intelligence from beyond our own atmosphere?
The moment the great shuttle cargo doors had split open, Remo launched himself with a two-footed kick.
Holy shit!
What is it?
It blew up! I gotta get out of here!
When he was in the clear, Remo looked around.
Where's the shuttle?
Retreated to a lower orbit.
Uh-huh. What about me?
There are no rescue procedures for an astronaut adrift amidst so much dangerous space junk. The Atlantis could be imperiled.
That's it? No procedures? So end of story?
You knew you were expendable from the day you joined CURE.
A cold sensation settled in Remo's stomach.
Smitty, you aren't gonna leave me up here to die.
I have no choice.
Think of what Jun will say. Think of what he'll do.
I am thinking.
Join the further adventures of Remo Williams and Master Chun in Destroyer 105, Scorched Earth. It's out of this world.
Next on Fox News, where Martians go, trouble follows.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.